Now I want to move on here to about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, I discovered that you are actually also a well-known and very rigorously published sociologist. Is that the correct term, sociologist, with the your series and the Copycat Effect?
Well, I don't have a PhD in sociology or in any other field. You know, I've been called anything. Many things, but I've been called a social scientist, you know, a public affairs writer, a suicidologist. I have a degree, as I mentioned, a psychiatric degree in psychiatric social work or clinical social work with a subspecialty in child welfare. But I've mostly written and done major million-dollar federal projects in the area of suicide prevention and working with law enforcement, working in with adoption and adoptive kids. And so when I decided, I wrote in 1987 a book called Suicide Clusters.
Yeah.
And in my sort of radical Freudian way, I decided that I was kind of tired of all of the academics and suicidologists that was talking that suicide clusters didn't exist. It was kind of, they said, that's a word of the media, and we don't have that as a real phenomena. So what I did was took, you know, my research skills from all of this other work that I do, which, you know, goes across every field that I'm really involved with,
yeah,
and saw suicide clusters as a real mystery. I don't think that we really know and understand why humans kill themselves and die by suicide. So, but beyond that, people do it actually in clusters, and I was able to backtrack in that book, and then I've you know, taken that material, the relevant material, and put it in my new book, The Copycat Effect, and looked at suicides in clustering back to the 4th century B.C.
Oh, wow.
And so suicide clusters has been around a long time. And then what I wanted to do with The Copycat Effect was really look at this whole notion that clustering, behavior contagion, is a real thing, and that the copycat effect does exist, whether it's stories in the newspaper about alligator attacks or shark attacks or the scare that often, and I also talk in that book all about how death sells. If you look at the news, it's all about hurricanes and tornadoes and mine disasters and assassinations and terrorism.
Yeah.
And you can just go through a half an hour of broadcast news, and there's maybe one happy story in there, and then and it's probably a happy story because somebody survived cancer that was supposed to have killed them.
Yeah.
You know, so you look at that and you think, why of course people are going to die from homicide and murder, suicide, because that's the way the whole attention span for human beings is now set up. And the copycat effect just takes that beyond that and talks about how people actually copy each other's suicides, for instance.
Yeah, I really enjoy the copycat effect. I was, like, I had never, it's surprising to me that you have these two separate worlds in a way, because I'd never known that Lauren Coleman, critically acclaimed father of cryptozoology, was also such a well-known social writer as well, so I'm really impressed by that.
Thank you.
Now, how do you sort of juggle those two specializations? Do you find that you get a lot of flack at all because of your crypto work when you're in the more mainstream sort of work with the suicide clusters and now the copycat effect, or are they just totally kept separate?
Well, it's intriguing because on the one hand, if you look at my life, I was in college, and I decided I needed a job, and I knew I was pretty good working with people, and cryptozoology isn't the kind of thing that ever earns you a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I have not got my MacArthur grant yet. No, there's no money, and the books, you know, unless you're a fiction writer, you get a lot of money for books, but most of my, even though I've written 27 books, they're all nonfiction.
Wow.
They don't get me a lot of money. So I needed a regular job, so to speak, and that regular job was working with people, frontline, you know, in juvenile halls and working in residential treatment and running programs like that, and then working in academia, teaching documentary film, teaching social work, anthropology, so that I could at least live and survive as I really did what I was passionate about, which was cryptozoology. But slowly they merged, and it's quite obvious that I can write and I can do research projects, and they kind of combined. And so when I moved to Portland, Maine in 1983, I got a job at a university doing research full-time and then taught a little bit on the side, and it gave me the freedom to do more cryptozoology, too. What is funny, of course, is that if you're in academia, that people are going to be, walk around with their noses up oftentimes and say, oh, that's the guy that investigates little green men. Of course, I've never written a book on UFOs or little green men, but that was the way that people try to ridicule me. And it didn't affect me because, I mean, I've been in the field so long that it's pretty hard to, I just take a lot of this with a sense of humor because there's all kinds of silly people in the world and I'm not that silly, I'm pretty down to earth about what I look at. In terms of suicide and all of that, I just got deeper and deeper into that because it became a focus and a specialty. So much so that when I decided it was 10 years ago, to retire from the university to really look at getting away from academia, I started consulting on the side in suicide prevention. And so that I could have at least some stable, even though my income literally is, zeroes out because of my expenses are about there too.
Yeah.
At least that was a way to pay the mortgage and pay the oil bill here in Maine.
Yeah.
And then cryptozoology was on the side. And now it's flipped around so that I'm almost seen full-time as a cryptozoologist, but I still am in that field of suicide prevention so that, for instance, during the, I think it was the second week of January of 2006, you could pick up a Sports Illustrated and there was a huge story about football suicide clusters. And I'm interviewed in that, and across 4 or 6 pages, there's quotes from The Copycat Effect in my books on suicide. And nobody reading that would know that I'm also a cryptozoologist. So sometimes the twain doesn't meet, but I'm very open these days talking about, I think there's a lot of overlap. You have media flaps in both of them.
Yeah.
They affect sightings. It affects the way kids are going to react, either saying they saw a Bigfoot or, unfortunately, for the more vulnerable teens and older people around us, it's in terms of killing themselves. So there's a lot of understanding about interviewing, about manipulation of the media that occurs that I really have taken from both fields to put in Copycat Effect or into my other work about cryptozoology.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about these football suicide clusters, because I've never really heard about this before until you really just mentioned it.
Well, in my book, The Copycat Effect, I do a whole chapter on baseball player suicides. In the 1980s, I was the first person to study the suicides that were occurring in Major League Baseball. And I had studied it so much that by the spring of 1989, I wrote every Major League manager, CEO, general manager, and also the commissioner of baseball, and said that we need to wake up. Statistically, we're going to have some suicides in this year, in 1989, and we need to get some funding. You need to really take a look at the fact that you're not doing anything to prepare some of these baseball players. As it turns out, that was the summer that Donnie Moore shot himself.
Oh, wow.
Donnie Moore was the Angels pitcher that gave up the final pitch that David Henderson turned into a home run, and the Angels didn't go to the World Series, and the Red Sox did that year in 1986. But he killed himself 3 years later after he'd gone to the minors, and I'd studied and found out that baseball players had kill themselves within 3 years of when they retire from Major League Baseball or as an older man.
Oh, wow.
So that here we had Donnie Moore plus 3 other baseball players kill themselves that summer.
Oh.
So I was phenomenally right in my prediction. And baseball, I think it was the next year, got together the BAT program, which is assistance to retired baseball players to try to, somebody falls on bad times or they need some therapy, they'll get their help. Now, transferring that to what's happening up here in Maine is there's a one city, Winthrop, Maine, and to what, excuse me, what the local people started seeing is that kids on that football team were moving away. They were graduating from school, moving away, and then over the space of 3 years, five of them had killed themselves. And the only thing they had in common was that they were football players. There were all kinds of other risk factors, such as them owning a gun or drinking or stuff like that. But what we know about suicide is it takes many, many factors. You know, it's not just the breakup with a girlfriend or the loss of a job. It's a bunch of different factors together with teenage impulsiveness. But what the copycat effect says is that most teenagers and most adults who choose to kill themselves do it because the model of suicide has been put in front of them. And it's not about if you talk about suicide, you're killing, you know, actually people want to talk to you about suicide because then that keeps them alive. It's when they're not talking about suicide and they're reading in the media about it, or they're hearing through the internet or IM or you know, word of mouth that so-and-so killed themselves. They then think, well, I'm a football player, I'm a young white guy, you know, from a little town in Maine, the same town as this guy, I'm under stress, maybe I should do that too. Because suicide's really about getting away from the pain.
Yeah.
Most kids don't want to die, they just are in incredible pain, whether it's physical or psychological, or for some kids it could be, you know, a bunch of credit card debts. For somebody else it could be because they're getting kicked off of a sports team. So these things mount up and then they don't talk to anybody. And for boys, you can see how that happens.
Yeah.
Boys tend to hold on to things and keep them inside, whereas young females tend to talk to friends, cry, more attempts, different things like that, and get more of a chance to stay alive.
Yeah.
So the football cluster got to be such a thing up there that there's monuments that now they're being, you know, CNN and MSNBC and everybody is circling around now because it was a huge spread in Sports Illustrated. So I don't think it's quiet yet, and we expect to have more media in the state about that.
Now, why don't you talk a little bit about the sorrows of young Werther, because you sort of point to that as pretty easy proof of the actual validity of the copycat effect.
Yeah, well, young Werther was a book in which that was the 1700s, which a man had in the book, and it was a fiction book by the same guy that did Faust. So it was a famous book in Europe. He never could quite get back to the one woman he loved. So he talks about sitting on a writing table and writing out some words to her and then taking a gun and shooting himself and bleeding on the floor. And he has on, a yellow coat and this book and everything. So what started happening is after that book came out, all across Europe, police were finding men that were wearing the same yellow coat, they had the book in front of them, and they were killing themselves. And that's very much like what we found in 1962 after Marilyn Monroe died.
Yeah.
Young blonde women, usually bleach blonde women, were taking overdoses of pills to such an extent that it increased the suicide rate in the United States for the month after Marilyn Monroe's death by 12%.
Oh, wow.
Actual number of 197 people over and above the normal rate died. And it wasn't the kind of thing that there was a peak and then there's a valley afterwards. With the suicide phenomenon of the copycat effect, you get these clustering and these bumps in the rate and then it never goes back again.
Oh, really?
After Freddie Prinze Sr. killed himself with a gun, you had an incredible spike in the Hispanic rate. Young Hispanic men with guns were killing themselves. And it happens over and over again. When Donnie Moore killed himself very soon after that, a Sacramento Suns basketball player killed himself. So you see that, and what I after Kurt Cobain killed himself, 70 people around the world. What I tried to say is that we can't let our guard down, and that the media actually, not that they're to blame, they certainly are contributing to the whole notion that they're creating new suicides.
Yeah.
Celebrity suicides that are overblown, that really are not thought about more correctly, that it's not a great thing to do, you know, and there may be some hotline numbers at the bottom of the article. But most of the celebrity suicides where they're graphic, they're talked on and on about with talking about the family and how much pain this has had to the family, you get other suicides afterwards because people see it as a quick way out and the end to all of their problems.
Yeah.
And the Hemingway family is a great example because here you have five. I was a consultant to NBC News' Unsolved Mysteries episode on the Hemingway curse.
Yeah.
And five suicides in that family, and Margot Hemingway did her suicide 30 years to the exact weekend that Ernest Hemingway killed himself.
Now, what was the post publication of The Copycat Effect? What was the reaction from the media to the book?
Oh, well, I met with editors, and I've had some things, and I think the Boston Globe did a review of it, and they tried to, put it down, and I think what has generally happened is they've tried to ignore it because there's media guidelines in there. There's media guidelines from the CDC that I said have been ignored for 20 years, and I was trying to get people interested in it again. Within the suicide world and the suicide prevention world, it's been, applauded, but within the media, their way of killing something, of course, is to just ignore it.
Yeah.
So, I've not exactly been invited on CNN after a series of school shootings.
Yeah.
In which I might want to talk about how one of the reasons that there's school shootings in the country is because the media talks about them so much.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I can see why they wouldn't want to face the culpability of it and would sort of bury it.
I've been on All Things Considered, and I've been on, shows like yours, as well as Coast to Coast and Unknown Country and places like that, but the mainstream media certainly likes to keep away from it. It's only the NPR, the alternative mainstream that I've been on.
Yeah. Now, in the book, you say that you were kind of worried about reader copycats. Was that something that you struggled with when writing the book? You didn't want to sort of put that in the minds of the people that were reading the book, right?
Well, I certainly wanted to let people know at the end of the book that's something I struggled with, because I think that any writer who's talking about writing about suicide might actually lead to other suicides has to consciously think about that. And I carefully, chose my stories. And I also, it's sort of the antidote against it being a copycat stimuli is by bringing it up at the end.
Yeah.
And so that people can see that they really need to take this book. Anyway, by the time somebody read 320 pages of my book, they'll probably fall asleep before they get it. At least I'm hoping so. But, and humor is a very important part of suicide prevention, so I try to make sure in my trainings and talks on that people really understand that the book is not about death, it's about living. And I think that by the end, it's opposed to the media, which has rejected it, the ones that have talked about it have seen that it's really about examining and living.
Now, you cover a lot of different sort of media flaps in Copycat Effect. What was probably the most disturbing of them for you that was just chilling to you?
Well, I think what was most chilling when I was in the middle of it, and I wrote the book Suicide Clusters in 1986 and 87, and when that was happening, I could see we were really on a peak. And so what was going to be next? What was going to be next? I kept saying to myself, and I was totally shocked and surprised to see that there was a small period of workplace rampages that got so much publicity.
Yeah.
And that was when the media was switching over from really the big three to the big four to now, which is, the big 253 channels.
Yeah.
And so you see now wall-to-wall news channels that all they needed to do and all they wanted to do was, we don't live in California, so you can't put car chases on all the time. So they started putting on school shootings. And when the school shootings started happening in the 90s, I saw what was happening. As opposed to suicide clusters happening in schools, kids who were parts of those schools were coming in, suicidal kids, and 100% of the school shooters have been suicidal. They were coming into the schools and getting on TV for 2 years, for 2 days. And so it was really about 3 years before Columbine that this whole phenomenon began.
Yeah.
And you started seeing it in Arkansas and in Oregon and, you know, little rural towns that then moved to the suburban towns like Columbine. The Littleton. And I was shocked and aghast because I could see it happening right before my eyes. And the ultimate evidence that this was really media-driven for me was 9/11. Because as soon as 9/11 happened, school shootings were no longer important because they were no longer important for the whole year after Columbine. We had no school shootings. Because all the news was reporting on was terrorism, war in Afghanistan, war in Iraq, terrorism, 9/11.
Yeah.
So you didn't have what I think is really the adrenaline-driven media. And it just disappeared. It disappeared. And then it started popping up in Germany, in Turkey. And you got massive school shootings that were copying what we'd done in America a year before over there.
Yeah.
And now it started coming back, the Red Lake, Minnesota,
yeah.
And the other place in Minnesota that happened a few months before that. So I expect, and this is a prediction that I've said often, in March and April of this year, I think we're going to get a round of school shootings that we haven't really prepared for.
Why do you say that?
I think that people have let their guard down. And when I did the data and collected it and analyzed it for the last wave, there was two major periods of the year when we're getting school shootings, and that was at the beginning of the school year in September and October, and with an even bigger peak in March and April, with a little overlap into May. But it's at the end of the winter, and May is the number one month for suicides in the country for all age groups.
Why is that, you think?
I think that's because in the northern hemisphere, suicide is really related to isolation, violence, and homicide turned inward and homicide turned outward. Suicide turned outward is homicide. So I think that people go outside and they see individuals and couples, and they're not in a couple, they're still alone, their life is still miserable. And they end up killing themselves. And so if you look at what happens at school years, and the schools end anywhere from May to June in different parts of the country, people are not going to be happy with what the summer is going to bring and what the school year has left them. And they're going to, whether it's an excuse about bullies, they're a bully or they have been being bullied, no matter what it is, or a neo-Nazi holiday that may be, underneath it all, like Columbine happened on Hitler's birthday, and Efren, Germany's big suicide that was 22 individuals killed happened on Rudolf Hess's birthday. Very much connected to a calendar that I call the Twilight Language. All of that's going to happen. It's going to happen again.
Oh, man. Now, like you said, after 9/11, it seemed to be there was less coverage of school shootings and stuff like that. I seem to have noticed an uptick in missing person stories. Have you noticed that in the last like 2 or 3, 4 years, an increase in this missing person phenomenon?
Yeah. In my book, I actually talked a little section I call "Abducted by the Media." There was a whole period in there. In which we heard the missing children stories, and the Christian Science Monitor did an analysis of them and found out that it was a media-driven phenomenon, that the years before there actually had been more abductions, more missing kids, but the media wasn't interested in it, and so they were talking about it now. And the other thing is the whole SARS and, West Nile and all, there's epidemics, the whole world's going to die off with millions of people. We're beginning to notice almost every summer now there's a new disease that we're all going to die from.
Yeah.
And, right now it's the bird flu that we all should get ready to fund the government for all of the vaccines that they want to make. So, you know, it's a media-driven, it's a scared, fear-driven culture that we're living in right now, and whether it's abducting, you know, kids that are being abducted, or right now the stories are all about mine disasters, you know.
Yeah.
People die in mine work all the time. They should be safe. I'm not dismissing that, but you really have to look at the media just gets into their 3-day and 9-day wonders.
Yeah.
And they go wild with it. I mean, people are seeing Bigfoot all the time, but you hear about one story, and then over in Malaysia right now, you would think they're seeing Bigfoot every other day. They had one sighting last November, and we're still hearing about it because it becomes a fascination with the media.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what about fictional-type stories and their influence on society as a whole? I mean, that's a huge debate. Do you think the copycat effect is not just limited to news coverage, but also to fiction, like movie and TV shows?
I think to a certain extent, if you read closely my chapter on school shootings in the copycat effect, what I talk about is that three or four of those individuals had Stephen King's book, The Rage.
Yeah.
Rage in their lockers, or they'd been reading it. And The Rage was about a school shooting in which a guy goes into an algebra class and shoots the teacher and then shoots some students. Well, one of the first people that did a school shooting went into an algebra class and shot the algebra teacher in the back of the head, killed her, and then killed a couple kids, and then turned around and quoted from Stephen King's book, The Rage. And that happened 2-3 years before Columbine. So that after Columbine, Stephen King went on the Today Show and said that he physically is kind of ill because of what he might have written in The Rage. And The Rage, is the only Stephen King book that he's pulled from publications. And so he certainly knew the length, and he knew that the kids were reading this book and getting the ideas and really turning his art into action.
Now, how long ago did you publish The Rage in the first place?
Well, it came out in the 70s.
Was there any sort of violence after it back then?
Supposedly, he had based it upon a real-life incident, and then it had a little bit of copycat. But I think it's really the mass media, the intersection between a fictional novel, the Internet, and cable television that really all came together in the 90s for that book.
And I kind of heard this sort of funky theory that as soon as I heard it, I was like, I got to ask Lauren Coleman about this theory that someone had, and that was last year you saw a lot of stories about teachers having sex with their students, and they blamed it on the Desperate Housewives show. Do you think there's much credence to this plucky little theory? It's not mine, unfortunately.
Yeah, I don't think that the timing of that is quite correct. I believe the stories about people having sex with their teacher, and even the one in New Hampshire where she got her student to kill her husband,
yeah,
happened many years before a Desperate Housewife. That's sort of like in my book Mysterious America, I talk about the phantom clown scare that happened in the Boston area and also was in Omaha and Kansas and different places like that around New England. That happened in 1981, and a lot of people said that that was caused by Stephen King's book, The It, but The It was, or It was published afterwards. So sometimes, you know, these theories need time travel machines.
And, well, what did you see for the past year for trends that might have come up, like you said, that you think there'll be a rash of school shootings later on this year in March, April?
Yeah, well, 2 summers ago I wrote about and talked about in some different places I lectured or wrote about how beheadings was definitely connected to copycat. You didn't see, you know, there's been beheadings used in Islamic cultures for a long time, but their use in terrorist activities only started to take off after the media started telling us all about them,
yeah,
so much. And so I definitely saw that as a copycat phenomenon. I think the school shootings are definitely a copycat phenomenon that's carrying on. And right now, you know, it's once again something related to death, and I think the mind deaths are what the media is focusing on, at least to talk about whether or not we're going to get some more killings of journalists or something like that, because every time the media focuses on something, it tends to be used either by the homicidal or the suicidal part of our culture to really replicate it.
Now, do you find these sort of trends, do they build to a peak, or do they sort of start at the peak and then get subsequent coverage of smaller stories down the line?
Well, once again, I point to the media. If you look at the media, they get bored with things. And once they get bored with things, those individuals then move on to something else.
Yeah.
And they start going away from that. So you certainly see that happen with the news. It just builds. The beheadings became so commonplace that there wasn't a lot of reporting on them, so the terrorists decided to not use that tactic.
Yeah.
It happens too. One of the prevention ways in suicide, prevention around suicide clusters, is to get control of your local media, not to publish graphic details, to not even really mention it. And a lot of papers around the country, as opposed to even using the word suicide in an article, in obituaries, you read them very carefully and they say, so-and-so died unexpectedly at their home on Tuesday.
Yeah.
You don't know if that's, they died of a heart attack or suicide, but it's most oftentimes a suicide.
Did you find much of an increase after the Hunter S. Thompson suicide last February?
No, I think the media roundly, criticized that and made that into a joke, so much so that the other thing is you need a population of people that can identify with a person killing themselves.
Yeah.
So, Marilyn Monroe, Freddie Prinze, a young person like Kurt Cobain, you got people that were fans and were identified. Most people who might have liked Hunter Thompson were probably already out of their head on alcohol anyway, or had the gonzo kind of lifestyle that they sure wasn't going to do what he was going to do. So it's not something that's overly identified. When I looked into and wrote about the Heaven's Gate people, it was the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
There was a small collection of individuals around Heaven's Gate that did kill themselves. But beyond that, the Heaven's Gate cult was so self-identified as quote-unquote crazy that not many people would identify that they wanted to be like those people.
Yeah, so it requires like a devoted fan base.
A fan base or a strict identification. So like in a small community, if you have all football players that are all males and young, they can identify with each other.
Yeah.
And across the country, baseball fans or something, if like Ken Griffey Jr. killed himself, you'd have his devoted fans maybe, deciding they wanted to pick that method to die.
And in the book, you speak to sort of the change in vernacular as far as the term suicide, and then completed. Is that how do you explain
the language of suicide, especially as you're working with kids, and is something for 20 years I've tried to have the media. If you can imagine, we want to use the word successful with everybody. You're successful in a relationship, in a job,
yeah,
in your career, in sports, even if you're an athlete or a student athlete, successful in your grades and your dating. But then for a newspaper to say there were 3 successful suicides in Omaha this weekend, or Joe Blow had another failed attempt, I picked up a newspaper once and it said Newton, Massachusetts, young man fails in attempt to hang himself in front of church. The whole underlying message that is saying to kids is, well, you failed, so you got to keep trying until you succeed.
Yeah.
And that we don't like the use of the word succeed, we don't like the use of the word failed, because it gives teenagers the wrong message. Some people don't like completed suicide because they think, once again, you got to keep doing it until it's completed.
Yeah.
And other people don't like the word committed suicide because that really goes back to that it was an act that sometimes was punished by being committed to a mental hospital or committed to jail.
What do you prefer then for vernacular of that?
I just say die by suicide, kill themselves. I'm very straightforward. This is about death. It's just like dying from leukemia or a car wreck or something else. You're dead, and there may be some choice to it, but a lot of people make choice about having lung cancer or eating too many donuts and other different things that people are almost parasuicidal. Having unsafe sex and different things. And that's what we talk about, how there's a lot of different choices that people are really just as much making choices, and yet we don't put kind of a shame and sanction on that. So we need to really look at suicide differently.
And sort of like kind of to wrap it up, we're hitting right to the end here. Do you find yourself, when you're watching the news, on edge now, when you see stories, because I read the book, I found myself watching the news, and then I'd be like, oh man, I hope people aren't going to copy that. And the one I think of is this kid that went to Iraq over Christmas. I was like, oh no, now crazy kids everywhere are going to try and take, secretive trips somewhere. It's going to get ugly.
Yeah, well, since I've been teaching about the media for 30 years now, it doesn't put me on edge, and especially stories like that that have a high barrier to really making happen.
Yeah.
It's much more the stories in the local newspaper, on the local news, and sometimes the national news. It's about really the kid next door who's taken his grandfather's gun and shot up his family and then killed himself.
Yeah.
I'm much more worried about that, especially if they then interview all the neighbors and they say, well, he was a wonderful boy. He was just, we never saw this coming.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, right.
So, you think that sort of, like what you're saying is it puts into the mind of the viewer that is an option.
That is an option. That's a possibility.
And that's what causes the problems.
Right. And we know, that definitely those kids that are doing school shootings are suicidal, so they decide to turn their suicidal acts outward, and it's had a very lethal outcome.
Now, it sounds like you've done a lot of research into the school shootings. What do you think about the whole medicated student situation, where it seems like a lot of the kids that are doing the school shootings are on medication, or is that just another sort of overblown statistic type of thing?
Well, that's definitely getting the theories mixed up, and you know, I've talked to, of course, if a kid's depressed or they're suicidal, they're going to be on medication. It's not so much the medication that's causing the school shooting. They were already in such a vulnerable state that then they were put on the medication, because you have many people that aren't on a medication that are depressed or despondent or homicidal that then turn into suicide or the reverse. That it's just, that's very bad. That's sort of pop psychology that the media often picks up on.
Yeah.
I don't see a real connection there.
Okay. What do you see for 2006 for yourself in this realm of research?
Well, I think I'm slowly, deciding that the media is not waking up about this. I get very, very upset and disillusioned sometimes. I spend years writing a book like The Copycat Effect, and to find out that nobody is reading it, you can't even, get off the Amazon charts out of the 100s, 100,000s. It depresses me that the media really doesn't take a book like this, but the research that definitely shows there's a cause and effect and doesn't apply it to their lives. I'm just hoping sometime, someplace, there will be a tipping effect, and that maybe the media will wake up to how they're involved in actually creating tomorrow's headlines.
And do you think there will be a tipping effect, or you don't really...
I don't know if I'll be around to see it.
Now, do you think the effect of the 24-hour news has made it worse?
Oh, definitely. I think that there's so much that needs to be put on there. And, I still have relatives in California. I still see what happens with car chases out there. And every time there's a big story, it overwhelms all of the news channels. And so we're hearing about nothing good and everything bad. And, as I put in my book, there's documented cases of finding people who have sat in front of their TV for hours, and then they go out and they go into a cafeteria and kill 12 people. So it does have a direct effect.
Yeah, and where can people pick up the Copycat Effect or Suicide Clusters or any of the other books on this realm?
Suicide Clusters is out of print, but Copycat Effect is online, you know, through Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble and any bookstores. It's a Simon & Schuster book.
Okay, and they can find more information in that area of your expertise at laurencoleman.com as well.
Yeah, I do have a link to that book here. There's also a site that I've created called thecopycateffect.com.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Lauren Coleman, for this awesome interview and time to speak with you. We covered a lot of ground, not just cryptozoology, but sociology and media and all that. And just you're a real renaissance man, top of the field in crypto, and obviously you know your stuff here in the media. So thank you so much for the interview.
You're welcome, Tim. It was great talking to you on this sunny but snowy day.
That does it for this week's edition of Banal of America Audio. I want to thank Lauren Coleman for giving us so much time and covering so much ground with us. It was a real treat to have him on the show. I want to thank John Renault, who gave us the theme music for this week's edition of Banal of America Audio. I actually happen to have gone to college with Johnny Renault, and I just loved this song, and I wanted to use it as a theme song this week. I suggest you all check out Johnny's website, www.johnrenault.com. And that's johnrenaud.com. He's got music. He's an artist. Check out his stuff. Also, I want to thank Leslie, Chiron, and R. Lee of banalofamerica.com. Check out their columns at banalofamerica.com. Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays. Those 3 days, we offer you a slice of esoteric pie that you really can only get at banalofamerica.com. You're going to love it. Check those out. You heard a little bit, kind of, from Leslie and Chiron this week. Now come back to banalofamerica.com later in the week, Tuesday for Leslie, Wednesday for Chiron, and check out their columns. Leslie has Gray Matters, Chiron is the K-Files. And also on Mondays, we have R. Lee's Trickster's Realm. Her columns are getting picked up all over the place, really making waves in the esoteric world, so we're really happy to have R. Lee on board at banalofamerica.com. Thanks to Leslie, Chiron, and R. Lee for your help and support with the website and the audio series. Big thanks to all the great listeners out there who have found banalofamerica.com. Thanks to all the websites and the blogs who have linked up to us. Thanks to all the new people who are checking out the show for the first time because they saw the Lauren Coleman interview and they wanted to find out what he had to say. I hope you liked the show. Check out our archives at banalofamerica.com. We've got tons of interviews with great esoteric minds and many, many more coming down the line with some huge names you're not going to believe. If you're a longtime listener of Banal of America Audio, feel free to click the PayPal button. Throw some change in the bucket. We're not looking for any serious donations. We're just looking to help get by and offset the cost of producing the show. If you can help out, if you have the money, throw some change in the bucket. We'd appreciate it. That's the PayPal button at banalofamerica.com. You can find the columns, you can find the audio archives, you can find the PayPal button, all that at banalofamerica.com, and that is BINNALL of America.com, all one word. Next week, Jerry E. Smith, part one of two. Jerry is the co-author of Secrets of the Holy Lance. We're going to discuss in depth the Spear of Destiny, also known as the Spear of Longinus. We trace the history of this infamous esoteric item, from the Passion all the way up to Hitler and World War II, and all the various factions and rulers who managed to get a hold of it along the way. We're going to discuss various esoteric aspects of the spear, the present-day spear in Austria, and if it is the real one, relics in general, and tons more. It's an enlightening discussion on an often overlooked esoteric realm. It's the Holy Lance. It's the Secrets of the Holy Lance with Jerry E. Smith. Next week on Banal of America Audio, check it out. That'll be online March 4th, 2006. Until you hear from me then, thanks for listening. I'm Tim Banal, signing off.